she began really as a lyricist of the ocean. She wrote a trilogy of books, Under the Sea Wind, The Sea Around Us, and The Edge of the Sea, that really established her. The second book, Sea Around Us, I think sold about 750,000 copies. So she began her life really as a poet of the seas.
And she had been a marine biologist, right?
That's right, yes. I also had encountered Carson in sequence as a teenager growing up in South Africa. I'd come across the edge of the sea, and I lived on the edge of the sea, 10 minutes from the Indian Ocean. And the sea was my kind of saving grace in a very conservative, rather fierce culture. And I just loved what she saw. I loved her curiosity, her wonder. And I had had a childhood very much immersed in the sea. And it was not until many years later, in fact, after I immigrated to America in my 20s, that I read Silent Spring. So in returning to my own roots, I wanted to return to my own encounter with her and also get a feeling for the shape of her life as the voice changes, as the issues change, as she matures. So that was really the motive.
Did you feel like you discovered a different Rachel Carson as you reread her work?
Yes, I did. One of the things that I discovered was just the courage it took her to change subject and to change voice from that early Ocean trilogy to Silent Spring.
Which was a much more political book.
A much more political book, a much darker book. It's full of elegy, mourning, apocalypse, prophetic warnings, polemics.
And of course, this is her account of how environmental toxins like DDT were wrecking the environment.
Yes, exactly. And so one of the things that I began to think about was this question of courage and wonder, because it took a lot of courage for her to break with her voice, break with her subject, break with her audience. And indeed, Dorothy Freeman, who was her great friend and indeed the great love of her life, warned her at the time. She was absolutely aghast. She said, "You're going to lose your audience, you're going to get depressed, and people will never hear from you again." And an interesting remark I came across in that reading was a remark that Carson made, where she said that she wasn't only doing it for society, but for her own future peace. That if she remained silent, she couldn't be at peace with herself.
So, I mean, it's a fascinating story. I mean, really, what you're describing is a person who loved being outdoors, especially loved being by the sea.
Yes.
She'd written so eloquently about it. And then she came to a point where she realized, you know, I have to do more than just revel in the glory of nature. I have to engage in politics because there are real threats out there that are destroying what I love.
Absolutely, absolutely. And she wasn't only passionate about being by the sea, but being in the sea, and particularly in the edge of the sea. She's pottering about in tide pools. And my favorite photo of her is bent over, sort of with the water halfway up her calves, just peering down into a pool. And she and her friend Dorothy, that's what they love to do, to mingle a childhood curiosity with a scientific sense of wonder as well.
Hmm. Now, I know you brought in a few passages from Rachel Carson's writing. And do you have one that would reflect
some
of this?
Yes, I do. One of the interesting things about Carson is that she grew up in rural Pennsylvania, not far from Pittsburgh, a very long way from the ocean. But early on, something in her was seeded, a passion for the ocean that led her ultimately to marine biology. So I'm just reading from an essay she wrote in 1951, describing that autobiographical background. "I seem to have been born with a fascination for the ocean. For years before I had ever seen it, I thought about it and dreamt about it and tried to picture what it would be like. I loved Swinburne and Masefield and all the other great poets of the sea. The stories I wrote for my classes in English composition often had a marine background. After I became interested in biology as a college student, I very naturally came to specialize in marine biology. At the Marine Biological Laboratory at Woods Hole, I had my first prolonged contact with the sea. There I never tired of watching the tidal currents pouring through the hole and the waves breaking on Nobska Point after a storm. It was there, too, that I first discovered the rich scientific literature of the sea. But it is fair to say that my first impressions of the sea were sensory and emotional, and that the intellectual response came later.
Oh, that's lovely. And it's worth pointing out that Rachel Carson was one of the great writers about wonder, the experience of wonder. In fact, she wrote a book about wonder.
Absolutely. She was originally going to be an English major, and so it was the poetry of the sea that got her first. But that led her to the scientific fascination. And I think she retained both. Towards the end of her life, after the success of Silent Spring, but also after she was very ill and she knew her time on Earth was limited, she started writing a book introducing children to wonder because she realized that was the autobiographical thread and that if you can get children to observe passionately, to immerse themselves in the natural world, that is the beginning of all sorts of things, leading, among other things, very often to scientific careers.
Now, there's a tragic element to Rachel Carson's life as well. She became very sick, and I don't know if it was while she was writing Silent Spring. And I mean, there's sort of a terrible, I don't know if irony is the right word. I mean, she's writing about environmental toxins, and she develops breast cancer at that very moment.
Yes. So she battled. She really battled with writing through that, and she had rheumatism and various other afflictions, heart disease, and it was a struggle, particularly towards the end.
What was the reaction when Silent Spring was published in, 1962?
It was immense. Partly for the book itself, but there was also a PBS documentary that came out shortly that was, I think, watched simultaneously by 1 in 10 Americans, which is absolutely huge. It had been serialized in The New Yorker, 50,000 words over 3 issues. President Kennedy acknowledged it. There's no question that it contributed a great deal to the forming of the EPA, the Clean Water Act, the Clean Air Act, Endangered Species Act.
Wasn't she also attacked by the big chemical companies?
Was,
I mean, DuPont, Dow, Monsanto.
Right. DuPont, Dow, Monsanto, Velsicol. And this was a time when I think 1% of tenured scientists in America were women. So she was very, very vulnerable on that front. One review that I recall by a professor at Vanderbilt, in the medical school at Vanderbilt, the title of the review was Silent, Miss Carson.
Keep quiet. Yeah, shut up.
Absolutely. And a former U.S. Secretary of Agriculture said, how can a spinster possibly be interested in genetics? She's probably a communist. So the fact that she was a woman, the fact that she was not married, the fact that she did not have children were all wielded against her. Overall, I think the reception of the book was very positive, but she did suffer these brutal misogynist attacks.
Recently, you went to South Africa to participate in a symposium, give a series of talks on Rachel Carson, 50 years after Silent Spring was published. Does she have much of a following in South Africa?
You know, one of the interesting things about Carson is that Silent Spring in particular has resonated in so many different contexts, in so many different worlds. Even though the science has moved on since the 60s, there are certain issues that she raised that resonate, like the question of food security, the question of environmental justice, unequal exposure to risk, unequal access to resources. Those are very contemporary issues.
The fact that the poor tend to be much more exposed to these environmental problems than the rich.
Absolutely. Another aspect to this journey I took through Carson's writings was that I just finished writing a book called Slow Violence and the Environmentalism of the Poor. And it had largely been inspired by Carson. And I was writing about writer activists engaged in environmental struggles in the global south, places like Nigeria, India, the Middle East, where the conditions are even harsher than those in the rich nations of North America and Europe. And I could sense the resonance that her work had had in these different corners of the world. And I also came to appreciate more something that she wrote at one point, where she talked about the secret tension between love and despair. These activists in the Global South were fighting extraordinary odds, and I was constantly searching for hope. And there were stories of hope, sometimes stories of martyrdom, people killed for their commitments. But this tension between hope and despair was something that really resonated with me, and I was exhausted even from writing the book and entering vicariously into those toxic worlds.
Now, there was another phrase that Rachel Carson used, death by indirection.
Yes, that really reverberated for me when I first encountered it, this idea that we live in a world where death is cinematic, it's spectacular, it's instant. We know what it looks like. It's a bullet to the head. It's a collapsing tower. But the insidious death that gets postponed, if we think of, say, Agent Orange, over generations, in many ways, those are the most fearful kinds of threat and also the hardest for artists and writers to represent because they tend to be unseen and invisible and they occur over long periods of time.
Now, Rachel Carson died in April of 1964 at the age of 55. She was quite young when she died. How do you see her legacy today?
I see it as immense, and it's not restricted to the United States, particularly as somebody who was growing up in the world of synthetic chemicals and plastics and a certain version of the American dream that was dependent on those new products. I see her legacy as insisting that in the rush to product development, we needed to have also a rush towards regulation, because we really had no idea of what we were unleashing in the world, both in terms of individual chemicals and the way those chemicals would combine.
So if synthetic pesticides were the thing that she was especially warning about back in the 1960s, what would be the comparable threat that we have today?
Well, I think one of the things that struck me in rereading her work was how strange it is to read all that environmental writing without the backdrop of climate change as the central, decisive issue. And in a sense, climate change is also death by indirection. It creeps up on us, and it's one of those issues where you can see people kicking the can down the road until there's no more road.
Now, I know you brought in another piece of writing by her, which was actually read at her memorial service after she died in 1964. Could you read that?
Sure. And this is a letter that she wrote to Dorothy Freeman. It was one of the last things she wrote, and she was reminiscing about a wonderful September day they spent at the beach. I think it really captures her spirit and her sense of wonder. "Most of all, I shall remember the monarch butterflies, that unhurried westward drift of one small winged form after another, each drawn by some invisible force. We talked a little about their migration, their life history. Did they return? We thought not, for most, at least, this was the closing journey of their lives. But it occurred to me this afternoon, remembering that it had been a happy spectacle, that we had felt no sadness when we spoke of the fact that there would be no return. And rightly, for when any living thing has come to the end of its life cycle, we accept that end as natural. For the monarch butterfly, that cycle is measured in a known span of months. For ourselves, the measure is something else. When that intangible cycle has run its course, it is a natural and not unhappy thing that a life comes to its end. That is what those brightly fluttering bits of life taught me this morning. I found a deep happiness in it. So I hope may you. Thank you for this morning."